So, thanks, Ron. Yeah. So this is module one, which we'll talk about today, is the story of creation. And module two is the calling to bless, which is the study of the patriarchs. And module three is leadership, which is the life of Moses. They flow on from each other. And all you've got here is like an architecture of the talks. So what I'll do is, the format is I'll talk for, 45 minutes or so, and then after that we'll have a bit of discussion. But this at least will give you, if you want to take any notes, it will give you the architecture and flow of the major points I'm going to make. Now, the way that I'll do this is I'll sketch a lot on the whiteboard, which is how I talk. And I'll give you the architecture of what we're going to talk about, a little bit of introduction, and then I want to throw to you to see kind of what questions people have and where they're coming from on this. I think the problem or the issue that confronted me for a long time in my life was living in a split world. So I've been a Christian for over half a century, and that's good and bad. I mean, the bad part of it is it's given me a lot of time to get a lot of things wrong, and kind of wander into different avenues of the Christian gospel. But when I was younger, I really lived in a split sacred secular world. So there was a world that I thought was, to do with God. And there was a world out here that was secular. And whilst I enjoyed lots of that, this was where my heart lay because of my faith. And that led me into almost having to deny interest in the secular world. For instance, ambition was something I had a lot of problems with. I had to pretend I didn't have ambitions to achieve things in the secular world because I thought that somehow or other that would interfere with my kind of sacred world. And it was a version of, what I would call the high road, low road idea, which is, that the high road one can take in life would be characterised by the word spiritual. And for a Christian, that might mean that you become a minister or a missionary. The really low road would be if you, became a businessman. And the only way to kind of absolve your conscience if you're a businessman is give money to people who are on the high road. And you get all sorts of dysfunctional behaviour as a result of it, which is these people here are, I'm meant to be very kind of disinterested in money, but in fact they're terribly interested in money because they're human beings. And I spoke to a dear friend of mine from Regent who was asked by a church if he would give a Saturday morning three-hour talk on the Old Testament, the Minor Prophets, and they offered him $300 or $400 to do that. He did the sums and said, well, he's a very conscientious guy. He'd prepare for 30 hours. He'd talk for 3 hours. So they were paying him less than they'd pay a babysitter. And he said, no, he wouldn't do it. And he kind of felt bad about that. And they were very, very offended. And so nobody felt good about it. I actually think he did the completely right thing. It's his livelihood. But it's this sort of, let's pretend that we don't care about money, but really we do up in that world. You could get in the middle ground by becoming a sort of a nurse or a teacher, sort of okay, it's sort of halfway, there's a bit of noble in it. If that makes sense to you, that was the world I lived in, a split world. And what that means is that one then channels one's energies if you become particularly serious about believing in God, you channel your energies a lot into the world of church programs, I think the church itself gets very interested in, and so to be successful, you've got to make the church that you're in bigger and better. So the whole story of somebody successful would be I'm in a part of a church that's big and great and we do all these things. So you're kind of having to pack all your energies into that. And I can remember Sarah, who's Finn's mum, she's probably, could be her now, but having the experience at a fairly large church and, you know, church, with people I really like in it, but she'd just begun school teaching and it was her first year of school teaching. So she was, and she's a really committed, very wonderful teacher, but she was exhausted. And so, hi, Tommy, how are you? Good to see you. This is my 9-year-old grandson, Tommy. Hey, Carlotta, come and sit down. He's been waiting for you all day, so you should better go and talk to him. Sarah, hello. I'm just telling the story of your experience of being co-opted at church. So the once they found out that Sarah was interested, was a school teacher, what they wanted to do was offer, you know, please come and take our youth group, you know, suck your energies into our, and she's exhausted. Not can we help you teach at Cherry Brook High, just can you come into our system. So it just becomes a very kind of sucking in introverted system. I frankly got really sick of it. It felt like a ghetto to me in terms of, begin to feel incestuous and just wrong. And this is when I was in my, you know, late teens and so on. But nonetheless, my worldview had blocked me in. I didn't see any other way out of that. Essentially, what I would say is let me just pause there and say, does that ring bells for people? Well, essentially, the problem that I figured we had, which is a problem that everyone's got, is that the God that we served was bigger than us. Essentially, you know, God had a project and God had a view of things that far exceeded our capacity to comprehend it. And what you'll see in the Bible again and again is continual attempts essentially to narrow God and his project right back down to something that our present worldview can handle. There we go. my favourite example of that is when Jesus, the one time in his earthly ministry, he appeared in a glorified form on the Mount of Transfiguration to, was it Peter and James and John? And so they had the only experience recorded in the New Testament of seeing Christ in his divine status as a shining light. And the minute that experience had passed, their instinct was to build a booth, you know, to kind of commemorate it. It was just this instinct to kind of commemorate it, contain it, lock it all up, you know. And so this instinct to narrow what God does is what today we want to, over the next couple of weeks, is give all of us a larger and larger picture of the project of God. Now, in that aim of getting a larger picture of the kind of project of God and the interest of God and the nature of God, my favourite phrase is by a guy called Jonathan Edwards. I don't know if anyone here is a lover of Jonathan Edwards, but unfortunately, he was a Puritan out of the 18th century, and unfortunately, he had this kind of hellfire and brimstone sermon, which is, you know, about going to hell, which I don't like very much. And that's what he's known for, but the rest of his theology is actually quite mind-blowing. And he had a tremendous phrase for the sort of goal of faith. He didn't use words like sanctification. He didn't use any traditional language. He called it infinite enlargement. That, he said, our job is an infinite enlargement. And by that, he meant an enlargement of vision, of soul, apprehension and reason. And it's infinite, because God is the object and you will never, ever plumb the depths of God. And so if you do read, you know, for instance, if you ever want to read something to blow your mind, just get off the internet Jonathan Edwards' unpublished essay on the Trinity. I mean, I read the first sentence about 10 years ago and just stopped reading and thought about it for 3 months. Where is this guy coming from? You know, he's got this most capacious mind that a lot of modern theologians and philosophers think the 21st century still hasn't caught up with some of the things he was talking about. But I love that phrase of infinite enlargement, and because it sort of says, well, that's what we're on about, and it's very, very exciting to get enlarged. To. So that being the case, and the enlargement clearly has got to lock those worlds together. That kind of split world's not helpful, so we've got to lock those worlds together. Today, in talking about creation, because the only way to lock these worlds together, to actually beat this, you have to go right back to the beginning. There's only one way to do it, and you have to have a very strong doctrine of creation, a very strong worldview about Genesis chapter 1 and 2. That's got to be the beginning of everything. Genesis chapter 1 and 2 are very, very important for a lot of reasons, but one reason is arguably they framed the mindset of the whole Bible. A friend of mine, Ian Jagelman, once commented to me that he'd read this book where the people were basically arguing the writers of the New Testament, I mean, they didn't have... The text that dominated their thinking was Genesis chapter 1. If you actually start to think of all the kind of... if you read 1 Corinthians 15, the great chapter on the resurrection, for instance, it's all framed by Genesis chapter 1. So this epic sense of what God was on about in the very beginning is the only thing that will free you up. Unfortunately, most Christianity of all shapes and form doesn't start there. The view of God that we have is too narrow, and I might pause there. So what I'd like to hear now is just from what I've said so far, if you could just have a quick discussion at your tables with the people there about some of the questions you might have around this sort of topics, areas that I've alluded to, what you'd hope we might come across today. Just have a bit of a chat, jot some things down, and only for a couple of minutes, and then we'll just get a sense of where we're all coming from on these areas, and that'll help me to frame what I'm saying a little bit more to some of those questions. So that we can cover them. Over to you for a few minutes. Let's hear what some of you are saying. What are some of the discussion or questions or that were coming up? Don't keep me out of these discussions. I'm interested to know what people are thinking.
My favourite question that Arthur Robinson who raised it was, so why should I be a Christian? Fascinating question.
Yeah. Good. We might approach that indirectly. Right.
So, it's kind of a nice lack of clarity, but the way that we, in trying to reduce it to a question, we basically asked, does infinite expansion means that, for instance, if I'm infinitely expanding, does it mean that I, as a finite thing, continue to grow incessantly with no terminal point? Or is it infinite expansion in the sense that I'm a finite thing and connected in a series of other finite things beyond which there is always something else there?
This is a Drew type question. For those of you who don't know Drew.
Yeah. Those of you who don't meet, I apologise in advance. But yeah, just what exactly, I guess infinite was...
Yeah. What does it mean? Yeah. People generally, though, these topics are on song for people that we're going to talk about. They're relevant, discussable. Yeah.
And some of us certainly have a background where we understand this secular, sacred divide and the huge impact it's had on our lives and the bad worldviews that, you know, stem from that. And I think David was alluding to the fact it's a long journey to change your worldview. You might understand the theory of what's wrong, but to practically transform the way you live your life is just, I think it's a huge journey.
Yeah, I think the the concept of a world view is very important. The phrase is thrown around a lot. As you get older and older, it becomes more and more interesting to you because, if here's someone acting and they're behaving, they're doing stuff, deep down underneath the stuff they do, clearly is there, behind their behaviour is clearly their character and their personality. Also behind their behaviour will be their experience, where they've come from. And also behind their behaviour will be their skills. The deepest thing will be their worldview and belief system. And worldviews are really, really, the older I get, the more I realise that's where the action is, okay? So I actually have problem, I don't know about you, but I have problem, for instance, grasping evil. And one of the most famous examples of people confronting this, the challenge of evil was the Nuremberg trials. And at the Nuremberg trials, a famous Jewish-German philosopher, who was the late
Hannah Arendt,
went to the trials looking forward to seeing the devil. That this incredible, murderous genocide, to imagine a human being or a group of human beings who would authorise that, I've got to be watching The Exorcist. Because when we human beings try and characterise evil, it's like The Exorcist, or it's very, massive and dark and so on. And what she saw was people with the demeanour of accountants and bureaucrats. And, the other night I saw a show on Eichmann when they finally caught Eichmann. If you knocked over him, if you fell over him in the accounts department, you wouldn't notice him. He had his tie on, his suit, he wasn't sorry. He said nothing, he had his spectacles, he just looked so ordinary. It was really spooky. And she coined the famous phrase, the banality of evil, the ordinariness of evil. What I've come to realise is that what really makes people sick, dangerous or powerfully benevolent is their worldview. It's like as human beings we've got a choice as to which conversations we want to listen to. And if you listen to conversations that can shape your worldview for evil, then all that follows up here could be bad. So working on worldviews matters. And I think that the writers of the New Testament essentially were always working on a worldview. They wanted deep the tectonic plates of our belief systems, our reason systems to shift. They weren't interested in a kind of a surface level kind of set of policies to believe in. They wanted the tectonic shape of how we view the world to be very, very different. So when Edwards talks about infinite expansion, this is where the game is. So let's begin our little journey. The first thing that I want to talk about is there's a diagram in the booklets which talks about what I think are sort of world views. It's actually on the second page, this diagram here, that, down here is the kind of the forest floor, and we're in the forest. So this is life, we're in life, and we're trying to make sense of it. And if you imagine there's a mountain here, if I climb a little way up the mountain, I'm still in the weeds. And in terms of Christianity, I think the lowest vision of God that people have, which is probably the most common one in the world, is law-based. God's a judge. Ten Commandments, etc. Unfortunately, and all these things are true. None of them are not true. But if that's as high as you climb the mountain, you won't have any idea what's going on here. You will screw it all up. I come across so many teaching, it annoys me so much. Christians are so great at what I call sin spotting. And you read this sort of Bible studies, like, is it wrong if we did this? What if I did it and didn't feel that way? But what if I felt that way? And you're just like, spare me. It's incredibly pathologically introspective. And unfortunately, most Christianity, if you scratch anyone, I'm even talking about people with an evangelical doctrine, you scratch them, they'll fall back to a default of law. And we have a view of God as primarily interested in right from wrong. Now, essentially, that view is, in my view, a result of the fall of man, which is captured in chapter 3 of Genesis. In chapter 3 of Genesis, what was the tree they were commanded not to eat of? Yeah, the tree was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, most people read that and just miss the word good in it. It's like the tree of evil, you know. It's the knowledge of good and evil, i.e. morality. This was a condemnation. I'm condemned forever to look at the world as a polarity between good and evil. That's how my mind works. That's a curse. And it's not how God's mind works, if you can comprehend it. If you want to have your mind really blown, then read the phenomenal essay, Jonathan, by... After writing, what's his name? John Milbank?
Milbank.
She is, but for those of you who haven't, if you wanted to really read a mind-blowing essay, which said what I mean, my dear wife has thought for 20 years she's married a heretic, you know, and it's only as I discover more people who say the same thing that I can rescue my reputation. But, so I've been saying things like for 20 years, and it's very true, like in my Christian journey, the notion of sin has not been useful to me or entered my head for about 20 years. I just don't find it useful. Like, you know, I've got to arbitrate an argument or some sticky situation, and for me to start sin spotting, did that person sin or not? No, say 70% that person sinned, 20% that person. What about me? Did I sin? Am I sinning by judging? Oh, you know, I mean, it gets me nowhere. It's not useful. I think it's doctrinally unsound because, you know, the next area we get to will be redemption, where, in fact, Jesus has cleaned up the problems of sin. So Milbert's essay is called Can Morality Be Christian? Milbank. Yeah, the essay is, his essay is, and it's a stunner, Can Morality Be Christian? You imagine his answer is no. Which it is, it's no, can't be. That Christianity is not about morality. You can climb the mountain further and get into... the view of redemption, that is understanding the salvation of Christ, the sacrifice on the cross. And this is where most Christianity kind of hovers around this. And it's really, really fantastic. But if that's as high as I get, it won't give me a very good view back down here, because all it will tell me is that I've been redeemed or saved or something like that. It still begs the question why I have been. Doesn't really answer that question, except I was in a mess, which is just becoming, the reasoning's becoming tautological. The highest, the summit of the mountain is really a view of creation, which goes right back to the beginning and frames all of those things in a view of creation. So that's what we want to do now. So I want to develop a theory of creation for us this afternoon, and in doing that, let me go right back to Genesis 1, but let me go back to the sacred-secular split. And the first thing to realise is that this sacred-secular split owes much more to Plato than it does to Genesis. That what I described is as a sacred-secular world was essentially enshrined in Plato's writings around about the 4th and 5th century. And arguably, these writings have become the most influential writings in the world in many ways. I think he only framed what... In my view, Plato framed and gave an architecture to what is just the natural human religious instinct. And essentially, what he believed was, up here is a place of perfection. He called it heaven, the heavens. And in the heavens is the perfect everything, as we were talking about in Second Road yesterday. There is the perfect tree in heaven, the perfect flower in heaven, the perfect person in heaven, and that was the place of the forms. And heaven was, by definition, without a body. Down here is life, which is really, really messy. You know, I've got eyebrows and sneeze and fall over and graze my knee and have arguments with people, and there's mud, and it's just, and it's infinitely various down here and very hard to control. It's essentially messy. Now, the messiness is bound up with it being physical. That's the heart of the problem, is the materiality of the world I live in. So this is surely passing. This is surely just not permanent. This is permanent. So spirit up here, body down here. By definition, this, I could go so far as to say it's evil, or at least it's useless, and up here is where the action is. So if I were to say, now that view is called Platonism, and that infects many religions are Platonic. Most religion is Platonic. So our image, for instance, of a spiritual, you know, if I said, I want to actually ask you, you know, who is really spiritual, you know? Someone who's like, yeah, man, let's do this, you know, and gives you a big hug and wants to talk. Is that spiritual, or is it really spiritual to be ethereal, withdrawn from all, unbothered by all, slowly floating off, right? Almost losing my body, which is getting in the way of life. So most of us have this kind of somewhere in us, this view that spirituality is the body gets in the way. So that is essentially Platonic. That's the view that the writers of the New Testament and the writers of the Old Testament completely set their face against. So the Genesis view of creation is completely different, because this messy world here, as God created it, as you'll see throughout Genesis 1, repeats the phrase, it is good, it is good, it is good. You know, now, unfortunately, what we've done, us Christians, is taken Platonic thought into Christianity and turned it into a message of the gospel that kind of goes like this. You see, one of the problems you have if you have that Platonic view, and by the way, in the New Testament, when the guys wrote the New Testament, that view was not known as Platonic. It was called Gnosticism, which is that there's this higher order. And about a third of the epistles of the New Testament you can't understand if you don't realise they were fighting against a Gnostic opponent. Okay, so Colossians is a good example. Colossians was written against Gnosticism. You know, this whole Platonic thing. There are people who said, you want to be spiritual, you've got to kind of, you know, have you seen dreams or not? You know, because I have, you know, and I now, you know, are fay with the mysteries that frame the universe. And if you haven't had special mystical experiences, you can't, you know, so, and people get, you get very overawed by this language very quickly, rather than saying, oh, spare me, you know, I want to go and have a cup of coffee. I'm not interested. So, but Gnosticism was really impressing people, and Colossians was written against Gnosticism. Now, and by the way, just to complete it, and I hate to have to say this, but one of my favourite people brought Platonic thinking full stream into the Christian church, was St. Augustine, who in many ways is just one of the greatest of all Christians ever, but unfortunately we don't all get everything right. One of the big mistakes he made was sucking Plato in. But he was just baptising what I think was there. I actually think this Platonic thought is natural. If I try and imagine what it's like to be spiritual, that's where my kind of poor old mind goes. Anyway, so what Christians have done, one of the problems in Gnosticism is actually creation. Because if God is up there and he's really, really perfect, how on earth could he get involved making anything without getting his hands dirty? So, I don't know if you've ever seen these sort of shows where there's a, like an enclosed casing with either, you know, a sick baby in or something, and you've got to put your hands through in a glove so that you don't touch the baby. Well, that was their view of creation, except God had to have, they had up to seven layers. So God did something, but, you know, like through a glove, and then there was another layer and another layer. They actually had seven, so that by the time this happened, he had nothing to do with it, you know, and he was clean. That was just this, trying to preserve the idea there's a God and this stuff down here. So within modern Christianity, I think it comes to a worldview of something like this, right, you know, that God's up here doing his stuff and he's really busy, and one day he's got nothing to do and he thinks, I'll make the world, you know, a spare time job. So he makes the world down here, and then he gets on doing all the other important stuff that he's really interested in. The world kind of chugs along and it gets itself into a few problems. Sin enters, and he notices and says, oh, my dear, there's a problem. I'll save him. So this is the bungee jump model of salvation. So he sends his son down, saves the world, and goes back up again, and they just keep on doing whatever they were doing before we got into such trouble. And so our destiny will be to join them. You know, so we're sort of plugging along down here. One day we'll just be like them. We'll go up here and live in heaven forever after, and all this gets obliterated. So essentially that's kind of most evangelical Christianity, okay? Is that a fair characterisation? It's, for the sake of the argument, it's a bit quick, but I think it's if you've marinated your mind in something for 5 decades, you tend to have to make things simple for yourself. So within that framework, it's really hard for me not to believe that primarily I've got to go to church, primarily I've got to be involved in spiritual activities. Primarily, if I'm interested in, you know, anything outside of this, it's a waste of time, which was so that's why the sacred-secular split, you can't just adjust it easily. It comes out of a fairly deep worldview. Now, what's wrong with this worldview? Well, essentially, what's wrong with it, it begins here, which is the whole notion of creation. And in order to fix up what we think, we've got to go back to the notion of creation. Now, if I had time, I'd go into Genesis 1 and say more about it because it's really phenomenal. I would recommend to you, we're going to set up a website and you can download some good articles. My friend Rick Watts wrote a phenomenal article called Making Meaning Out of Genesis 1, and it's really good, and we'll load that up because he really gives a powerful explanation of that first chapter. So I'm not going to go through it because it would take us too much time. But my mind is quite framed by that article and others. But what we need is a much, much stronger view of what happened here at creation and what was going on. The view of creation that most has begun to intrigue me is a view that came out of Jonathan Edwards, and it kind of goes like this. This will take, you know, this will just lay a big thought. It'll take a while to absorb if you haven't already come across this way of thinking. Essentially, if I go right back into the nature of God and the Christian nature of God, the Christian nature of God is Trinitarian. And Edwards said, if I want to peel back to reality so that there is no more layers to peel back, I will hit God. Right? That was his essential point. I'll peel right back, and if there's nothing left to peel, I've hit God. And he asked himself, what is that nothing left to peel? Now, if you're actually in the Islamic faith, you'll have the simplest view, which is a total unity, indivisible unity. I've hit God. It's indivisible unity. There's one. Okay? So absolute oneness. Now, can't be divided any further, philosophically. If that is the case, if that is your worldview, then by definition, for instance, love is a secondary item because it only makes sense if there's another to love. So love can't be part of that view. Just can't be. Love makes no sense if there isn't another to love. So, if that were the view of God, I only could start loving once I'd created something. Then love would come in. So love becomes secondary to my nature, not primary. So my nature would primarily be about power. Edward said that the primary reality was, in this stunning phrase, this is the one that you'll have to think about for a long time, the idea of the idea and joy in the idea. This is the indivisible nothing. The idea of the idea, that is let's call that the reflex, and joy in the idea. So he sort of asks us to say, well, think of your own humanity. So if you think of, just ask yourself this question about yourself. Is it at all possible for you to have an idea without you having expressed the idea? And he said, it's not. I don't know I've got an idea until I throw it out of myself and express it and look at it. You know, if the idea does not exist until it's expressed. This is Edwards's point. So the idea of the idea is the expression of the idea. Can anyone give me another word for the idea of the idea? He didn't use. The word. So the word is in. I can't actually have an idea without a word. And you just try it as a little thought game. Try and catch yourself having an idea without having an idea of the idea. Just try it while you're, you know, having a shower in the morning or something. And you won't be able to do it. He's absolutely right. When I express an idea and have an idea, I don't just have it. I like it. I react to it. And I say, wow, I like that idea. That's a really interesting idea. And that is joy. So that is the Trinity described in Jonathan Edwards' terms, where the idea is the Father, the idea of the idea is the Son, Christ, the expression of the idea, and joy in the idea is the Holy Spirit. So Edwards would say strange things like joy sluices through the universe. And for a lot of Christians who think God is doom and gloom or cranky and angry, that's a law-based view of God. His view is that the heart of God is joy, unbridled, inexpressible, uncontainable joy. So what we have is a dynamic going on in the Trinity that is relational. So now I can actually say love. I can say what John said, which is God is love, because there is an iterative relationship going on in the Trinity. But what there also is going on in the Trinity is expression and communication, pre-existing creation, there's a dynamism of love and expression and communication. Essentially, if I were to go like that, and we can't expand these ideas, the creation or the created order becomes an extension of the word. It's a throw forward of God's uncontainable ability to express himself. To keep on throwing out of himself, to keep on expanding himself via a communication. Incredibly generous view of wanting to express. And so the world in Genesis 1 and humanity at the kind of crown of the world is an extension of the Godhead's desire to express and communicate.
I read something somewhere, Dad, just on that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Relatedness.
Yeah. It is. It's really. Once you start thinking of this, it makes it's a lot of sense. So there's a pulling apart and binding in all the created order. Now, if you've got a view anything like this, you can see that the thing I drew in the other board is completely erroneous. This is not a throwaway item. You know. I mean, once I got this, I said, like, God can't do any better than a camellia. Right? He can't do any better than a zephyr wind blowing across the ocean in the morning. He can't do any better than the colour of a sunset. It's his best effort. If it's not good enough for us, well then, you know, hang our heads in shame. But it's not like he's far more interested in it than we are. So the idea that this would be a throwaway item, that this whole dynamic is something he wants to stop and suck us back into this, which is actually impossible, is ridiculous. And only a view as big as this starts to make sense of the New Testament, where you get stunning phrases. I mean, one of the things that got me thinking about this was just years ago, I just at least had the power to read the words in front of me and realise I had no worldview to cover them. So when Paul would write in Colossians about Jesus, about Christ, he says, in whom all the worlds were made. It's just one clause, throws it out there. I mean, for me, that would be the start of an encyclopedia. And he just throws it out there. That's his worldview. In this man, all the worlds were made. So, you know, I can remember reading that thinking, what does he see? I can't get that. It's like I had all this problem with physicality. How can the whole cosmos be made inside one person? It's not possible. I can't conceive of it. But this view here starts to make sense of it. So that's a very big view of the created order as extending the character of God and expressing the character of God. And it will lead to, inevitably lead to the fact that therefore the created order can never cease. He won't obliterate it. And the mistake that Christians have made, going back to the board here, so that's kind of saying, our view of this was minimalist and corrupted by Plato. Our view of the end, where we go to heaven, is now also got to be wrong, because this is clearly this activity will continue into a new heaven and a new earth. So the Bible is one of the more, heaven is one of the greater heresies we've invented. The idea that we'll go to heaven and everything is be destroyed is a heresy. And it is so wrong at the most casual reading of the Bible. It's like, I don't know, it's just like quite, it's bizarre. It's Monty Python-esque. I mean, it says in Revelation 20, 21, if you read it, that God comes down to the earth and creates a new heaven and a new earth. I mean, the words are there. I'm not making it up. Just go read it tonight. It's fabulous stuff. His habitation is here. He doesn't take us to heaven. He comes to earth. As dear Rick said to me, because Rick, like me, you know, we had a similar background, sacred, secular, Rick Watson, you know, he said once, you know, all his life he'd been imagining this kind of great ascension he'd have as a Christian up to heaven, and imagine my surprise when I met Jesus going the other way. And it's there in Revelation that what actually we have to look forward to is actually a stunning hope where the whole created order gets animated by the glory of God. And at the moment, what happened in the middle here, this was no bungee jump, because without going too far into, you know, the created order and matter did indeed get corrupted. It is no longer capable in biblical terms of housing the glory of God. It has an instinct for it and a hope for it, but it can't house it. Were God to kind of indwell any person, any part of the earth, he'd blow it apart like a nuclear bomb. We can't, so the created order can't hold the glory of God. The promise is that it will one day. That's the great promise. Yes, Senator?
It's C.S. Lewis's Narnia
chapter. Oh, he talks about that a lot, doesn't he?
And especially the last battle. That's, it blew my mind. Just hearing it, we were playing it in the car. Just the whole concept that what was ordinary Narnia, actually once Aslan comes, there's this explosion of colour and of magnificence such as has never been seen before, and it's inexpressible. You can't put words to it because it's just it's amazing. He already had
So this can't be a bungee jump, this bit in the middle anymore, and we'll come back to that in a moment. So the bungee jump model is a wrong model, essentially the ascension. So that's a bit of an opening sweep. Are people still with me? Any other questions or queries on that?
Certainly one thing popped up for me just around when you said that going back to the oneness point, you can't have love in oneness, which I think is a really interesting point, but I don't understand why you can have power in oneness if you can't have love, power.
Yeah, I guess that'd be a long conversation. I think power is not reflexive. Power is really one way. So whereas love has within it the idea of the other. So love isn't one way. Love is dialogical, essentially. I've got Cedar, if you'd feel love as everything is one way, you know, he's just kind of pushing stuff on me sometimes. There you go. You'll get tutored. You'll get educated and changed, you know. So the idea of love has this sense of otherness in it, you know, that I have to absorb the other. It's very uncomfortable for us to do that. I have to take the other person as they are, not as I would want to frame them, you know. Whereas power requires no feedback. You know, I can obliterate you, actually. I'm just pushing out. I know that there's got to be something else for me to obliterate, but essentially my nature requires no reflexivity or connection or relationship. Couldn't really. I mean, we'd have to push that further. But so Now the question comes critically to, if therefore this created order is essentially good, essentially expresses the character of God, extends the character of God, the question then becomes, what's our role in it, which I'd like to turn to now, because the role that humanity has in this created order is really quite significant. And So in Genesis, the role is basically to rule the created order, to govern the created order. I want to expand that in for a few moments. But begin by just saying that we human beings, we all know we have this incredible instinct to control and shape things. I mean, it might express itself badly, but we actually have that as a really deep instinct. We want to understand, want to control, want to shape. We hate it when things are out of control. I mean, that makes sense in us. And so this idea that there is something in us that is essentially about rule over the elements is, I think we can all just identify with that. The question is, did God put it there? And is it part of a bigger game? And the answer, I would say, would be yes. There's a great little verse which you might not know in the Psalm 115, verse 16, which is a stunning verse, which goes, "The highest heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given to man." So there is this really strong sense of stewardship. There's really strong sense that our role in the created order is... special. And I see our role in the created order as continuing the act of creation. So I see us really as sub-creators who are continuing the work of God on the earth. Now, you'll be aware that the creation of humanity, as recorded in Genesis 1 and 2, has got a few features about it. The critical phrase... doesn't use the Latin phrase, imago Dei, which is in the image of God. No other aspect of creation was this phrase used. Another phrase, equally important, is capax Dei. I am capable of God. I am capable of apprehending God in a way an elephant is not, or a rock is not, or a flower is not. So humanity is made in the image of God and has a potential to apprehend God. He is not entirely strange to us. And I wanted to explore those briefly. The image of God phrase, which comes out of Genesis 2, the rule is Genesis 1, I think it's verse 27, where God commands humanity to rule. He commands humanity to rule. The image of God phrase, which is Genesis 2, so when the creation of humanity is recorded, it is different to the other modes of creation. The other modes of creation are declaration. God said, and that was it. So he could sort of, you know, he said and it existed, or it was shaped. But when he created Adam as you know, the archetype of humanity, he breathed life, he breathed his spirit into us. So it's a more intimate, almost like a kiss, really. It's actually not, it wasn't enough to just declare. He breathed himself. And there's a very strong sense that the soul, the nature of God was somehow or other impregnated on us. There is within us the DNA of the divine. So there's something about attributes in this, and there's something about role. They're both important. I think they're both implied. And I really, really like the idea that Francis Schaeffer talked about, that if I look at me as a human being, some things I share with the created order. So an example would be lungs, you know. Other animals have lungs, and I share that. So there's tons I share with the created order, but some things I share with God and not with the created order. The ability for reasoning and language and prayer and communion and so on. The attributes of God I have in his imagery. So this means that in a stunning way, we human beings have the imprint of God on us, but we also have feet of clay. One of the great speeches of Hamlet talks about this because it gives me almost a schizophrenia. You know, when Hamlet was wondering who he was, in one of his blacker moments, for those of you who don't know and love Hamlet, then you've just got to change. He says, this is very much based on Genesis. This speech of Hamlet is very much, it's to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. He says, I've lost my mirth, forgone all custom of exercises, and indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave or hanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire, why, it appeareth no other thing to me than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapours. He's depressed. So he's basically junked the creation. It looked like it was the habitation of God, but nah, it's just crap. You know, that he's really gone down. But then he goes to himself. Now, this is almost a parody of Psalm 8, which we're going to talk about in a moment. What a piece of work is a man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me. So I kind of got a choice. Am I virtually like God, or am I the quintessence of dust? And, you know, that's the great kind of debate in a way, but beautifully expressed. These attributes of God have always, or the recovery of them, have always led to some of the greatest achievements in all of the civilization. So I won't go there now, but the Italian Renaissance was really kicked off by the stunning essay by Pico, which he wrote when he was about 25. Bastard. And it's called On the Dignity of Man, and it's an incredible declaration of this top part here, that the attributes of... It is fanciful, but he imagines when God came to create man, he'd run out of raw materials so that he couldn't put in some special new raw materials. So he decided he'd make human beings a composite of all presently existing materials. So in a sense, we would be composed of every single bit of the created order. But he would give man this unique capacity to shape themselves. He would make them sub-creators like God. And they could make themselves into villains or saints by their decisions in life. It's like amazing in 1427. So the recovery of this has always inspired people. But exactly like Hamlet, you know, we tend to get caught between kind of massive hope and despair with a mess. That's part of the mess happening out there. The role is... essentially, the role recalled is a role of rule. I won't go into that one in detail because time's running out, but if you look in the we've got a diagram in there which explains it. I just want to give you some thoughts and you can think about them themselves. The word rule has become really problematic in that it can mean dominate and control. And certainly in the work that I do in organisations, human social systems... The nature of control is almost the most intriguing question. How do I control an organisation? How do I control a market? How do I control behaviour? How do I control, you know, and we have this enormous instinct for control, which generally we tend to move towards a power base for. And unfortunately, the church in most of its forms is most like that. I was speaking about some related matters yesterday in one of our... colleagues who's South American came to me and talked about how the way South American organisations are incredibly command control because the Catholic Church is so command control. And so we've had real problems, you know, post the fall of man. We've had real problems with this, and we just don't seem to be able to get it right. Doesn't mean the instinct isn't there, but we've had problems with it. The word rule for me, as I read through Genesis, there are the predominant metaphors are not about that. The first one is about a garden, Genesis 2. So a gardener, a carer and a lover of nature as a gardener is a tremendous metaphor for stewardship. And that was the first and primary role which you'd be familiar with in Genesis 2. So the world is a garden, you know, shape it, trim it, love it, nurture it. That's image number one. Image number two that is really about building and developing. This is actually only implied in Genesis 2, but very much more implied by God's work in Genesis 1, that God actually constructs and builds. So the whole idea of forward movement, enterprise, you know, it's clear to me that the creation story is not static. That it isn't as if God kind of freeze-framed. The picture's not, there was a freeze frame, this is the end of it, just don't stuff it up on me. Keep it exactly as it is. It's clearly not the picture. The picture is, going back to that view of God, dynamic, keep extending it. Okay, I'm a communicator, you communicate. I'm a designer, you design. I'm a builder, you build. Keep that throwing forward. So, and this comes in the parable of Jesus where safety first, risk aversion is not commended. You know, this parable of the stewards. He gave out the talents, and the only guy that was criticized was the guy who said, I'll keep it just as is. I'm not changing a thing because I'm so scared. The other ones are going to try something, you know, and let's develop it. So our enormous instinct for development as human beings, but, you know, in the history of the world, it's really been the Western world that's been most like this, is, I think, quite a God-given instinct. And the third one is celebration. Where to be a poet, that's captured in the phenomenal story of naming the animals. God did not name the animals. This is really important. He did not name the animals. He gave that job to Adam to do. And if you read about it, it's a really intriguing verse in Genesis 2, only just implied, which, you know, you can think about this verse for a long, long time. About all of Genesis 1 and 2 for a long time, but the Lord God, this is 19, had formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the air. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. You know, that's really intriguing. I wonder what Adam's going to call that, you know. Wow, I wouldn't have thought of calling that an elephant, but fine, if you want to, that's okay by me, you know. Implied in that is the idea that God has given us discretion that he won't interfere with. And he's really intrigued to see what we're going to do. You know, some more fundamentalist Christians wear these kind of armbands, you know. What would Jesus do? You know, Jesus got an armband in heaven. You know, what would Nerida do? And there's this kind of stalemate between them. Because he's actually intrigued to see what you're going to do. And so the power of language, the power of naming is this microcosm for how we can shape our worlds. Implied in behind this is probably the idea that God can learn, which, Sarah, I think you raised that question years ago, and I'm now kind of totally in the camp that says God does not know the future. There you go, that's something to think about. If you want to explore that one, who was I reading about who'd done a great job of exploring that? I don't know, I'm on my own. I could be right out on a limb on that one, but no, I was... Polkinghorne does talk about that. Yeah, no, he does. Polkinghorne talks about that in those tapes. So there's one. John Polkinghorne, you could try his views on that.
Clark Pinnock does as well.
Who?
Clark Pinnock,
yeah. The openness of God. So... one of the problems we've had is if our view of God is that he's completely knows everything, then gee whiz, if we want to be perfect, we'd be able to be like that too. So we've got to have every answer in every situation. And we've been kind of the idea of openness and exploration. Anyway, so that's intriguing to think about. The domain of rule is really important because I would see the domain of rule, there's threefold. I think there's definitely a personal domain. In other words, we rule ourselves first. I think it's a great principle of life. If you can't rule yourself, your emotions, your fears, your anxieties, then you can't rule anything else. If you have no vision for yourself, you can't have a vision for anyone else. So there's just an enormous centeredness around that. There, you go.
I think there's a verse in Proverbs,
isn't it? Neither rules itself is greater than neither rules the city. That's a great verse. Yeah, Proverbs. You don't know where it is, do you? Yeah. That's great. I love it. Yeah, he that rules himself is greater than he that rules the city, Proverbs. So the second one is really interesting, which is the natural world. That a sense of channeling the natural world and its resources is very strong. For instance, I would see the miracles of Jesus. And when we look at the miracles of Jesus, like, you know, calming the waves and raising the dead and healing the sick, people say, well, he did that because he was God. That was a sign of God's divine power. I don't think that's right anymore. I actually think he did that because he was fully human. That's a sign of what human beings are meant to be like. So if we want to know who we are, and the writer of Hebrews is extremely clear about this, you want to know who you are, you want to know your destiny, you want to know your attributes, a lot of this stuff now has got hidden. You won't see it in yourself, but you have to look to Christ because he's personified what it is to be truly human. And in my view, when he did the miracles, he was personifying the true power, calling and dignity of human beings. The last one is social systems. When I was younger, I thought social systems were, I don't know, artificial. Very used to seeing God in nature, very used to that line, but not seeing God in a social system. And by social system, it's running in everything to me, from a family to an organisation to a nation. But it's heavily implied in Genesis. I won't go into it now, but a lot of theologians have seen in Genesis 1, he didn't just create nature, he created the capacity for society. So the capacity for us to live socially was there. And that as the Bible goes through, that gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So the Bible doesn't begin, it begins with a garden, but what does it end with? A city. It's the New Jerusalem. So there's a very strong sense that this is the domain of our rule here. So we'll finish now with the last quick question, which is, having seen all of this, the obvious question is, but it's not true. You can talk about that and it might be inspiring, but it is not true. It wasn't true in Christchurch. You know, if that was true in Christchurch, someone would have put their hand up and quelled the earthquake. So, and it's not true in my life because my life's turbulent and often screwed up, and we do not rule. I mean, we might have the instinct to, but we don't control everything. Things control us most of the time. So that's a fair call. What we're going to finish on now is Hebrews 2, which I think is one of the most important chapters of the Old Testament. And essentially his answer in Hebrews 2 is important because I'll just talk about Psalm 8, which is one of the most important psalms of the Bible. So that Hamlet speech I read out is based on Psalm 8, which is, Psalm 8 is phenomenal. If you want to read the single best, to me anyway, discussion of Psalm 8 by Robert Alter, who talks about his poetry. Absolutely magnificent. It's one of the greatest poems ever. So simple, but Robert Alter and the Bible is poetry. So Psalm 8, here's how it goes. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. From the lips of children and infants you have ordained praise because of your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him? You made him, mankind, a little lower than the angels, and you crowned him with glory and honour. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds, the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and all that swim in the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. It's a stunning psalm. We should all know it off by heart. Crowned us with glory and honour. Put everything under our feet. It's amazing. And what does the writer of the Hebrews do? He does a Hamlet on it. He quotes it and he says, having quoted it, he quotes Psalm 8 and then he says, yet at present we do not see everything subject to mankind. He just says it is not happening. We know it's not true. You know, it's just empirically everything is not subject to us. We die for a start. So it's a screwed up, messed up world, and you can easily go to Hamlet on this and say, I'm a quintessence of dust. And this wonderful creation is a pestilent of vapours. That's what it is. Get over it, you know. Let's sit down and slit our throats. That was, and that's why it's one of the greatest speeches of all time, that Hamlet speech, because he walks between heaven and earth in it, you know, in 20 lines. And we all know what that feels like, don't we? I mean, I have days when I feel like I'm a god and days when I feel like I'm a worm, you know. And existentially, if I relied on it, I'd be really confused. And so he says, at present, we do not see everything put under him, he says, but then in, I think, possibly the greatest four words ever written, but we see Jesus. Empirically, evidentially, we see a man who shattered death, rose from the dead, managed everything, and it's true in him. And because it's true in him, it's true in us. That's essentially the argument of Hebrews, stunning argument. So let's finish with the bungee jump model, which was this model here. You know, Jesus' spirit up there with the rest of them. We've got a problem. Bungee jump, die on the cross, get it all fixed up, go back to heaven, and they go on their merry way. Oh, I give them the Holy Spirit just to keep them a bit happy. Now, that is theologically wrong because Jesus never returned to that kind of, you know, pre-incarnational state. It says he actually became the firstborn of a new creation. He's the prototype. He will always have flesh and blood. So the book of Revelation, the name, if you know, but the name, the Lamb of God is referred to about 20 times, I don't know. In other words, he's still got the wounds for eternity. He's still flesh and blood. When he rose from the dead, he rose in bodily form, not spiritual form. When they went to the tomb, they didn't see a body that the spirit had left. They saw nothing. No body. So what happened in these 3 days? What happened? And the problem that we have is that Christianity is basically built around the doctrine of the cross and redemption. And that is wrong. It needs to be... That's my new symbol, by the way. J-curve, ultimate J-curve. It should be built around the resurrection. So, you know, a great critic called David Gaffin, whom your dad, Hannah, put me onto, wrote a book called The Soteriology of the Resurrection. And he made the obvious point that most 19th century, 20th century theological books, all they talk about is dying on the cross. He counted the pages up, you know, Hodges, the systematic theology. Just go through them. It was like 119 pages on, you know, all about atonement and sin and the washing away of sin and all this sort of stuff. And then, oh, by the way, he rose from the dead. And so my view of the resurrection of the dead was like, can't keep a good man down. Like, why did he rise from the dead? Well, because he's divine. He had to. It's, you know, just like after the job's finished, he's got to rise. So, in other words, it has no mechanical, operational connection to redemption. Do you see what I'm talking about? That's what Gaffin makes the point. The resurrection is something that happened after all the work was done. Okay, the resurrection began in the tomb. And in the tomb here, in 3 days, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit had this incredible recreation. Is a better way to, it's a pity we got the word resurrection. Call it a recreation, where they created new molecules, new cellular structures, new atomic structures, new laws of gravity, and they made a created order that could house the glory of God. And that was in the body of Jesus, and he rose in bodily form. Does that make some sense to anyone? It's a stunning thing. And in bodily form, what they saw, and it took them about 10 to 15 years to get it, was, wow, if he did that, that's ours. He's the firstborn. So 1 Corinthians 15, you've just got to know that book, that chapter, back the front, 1 Corinthians 15, where he is the first fruits of the new creation. So I'm going to look like him, or else 1 John chapter 3, phenomenal book, not John's gospel, John's epistle. 1 John chapter 3. We don't know as yet what we shall be like. You know, we speculate, what will it be like, what's like after death and so on. We don't know, but we know this, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. You know, he's the prototype, we'll be like Jesus. So all the qualities that were won down here in this recreation have actually reaffirmed rule. But let's just write the word resurrection in front of it. It's a resurrection rule where Christ has a mind that can contain glory. He has a body that can contain glory. And the great promise in Isaiah is of the end days is the glory of the Lord will fill the earth like the waters cover the sea. And because the resurrection wasn't just to save humanity, it was to save the trees, to save the animals, to save the rocks, to save the wind. He has recreated them all. One of my favourite phrases in all problem solving is this little one called synecdoche, which those who know me know I love this word. Synecdoche was this Greek word for metaphor, but it was for the particular type of metaphor that represented scale change, where a little thing represents a big thing. So I'll say the sails to refer to a ship, or the crown to refer to the whole apparatus of government. So that's a synecdoche. So the crown is obviously just a tiny little bit, but it represents the whole. And as a great rhetorician once said, essentially it's about scale change. And this great rhetorician said, it's actually like fractals in the new physics. Because one day I was driving down to Wollongong to talk to a client, and my mind was running around saying, but how could three days fix everything? How could it fix Stalinist Russia? How could it fix the Nazi regime? How could it fix the mess in Australia? How could it fix my life? How could it fix millions and millions of people? It's too much. How could you do one small thing contained in one person in a time and event? How could you do that and solve every problem? And then suddenly it just hit me, it's a synecdoche. It was the greatest scale change play ever, which is what actually, if you want to, Romans 5 talks about, which is I will solve all the problems in one man. So this now gives us the trajectory, I think, of hope. And that plus the idea that the created order will continue, but not as it'll be, the created order will participate in the whole resurrection, which hasn't yet happened. So this kind of resurrection power hasn't been shared abroad. In my mind, you know, I mean, I think it's a lot easier for us to believe in these things, and if Ron does a gig for us, it'll get even easier. And, you know, the whole new physics, just it's so counterintuitive. And, I mean, one of the counterintuitive things in the new physics was if I split an atom, you know, would it destroy a city? You know, like 100 years ago, no one could conceive of that. If I could just split the energy in an atom, that's all I'm doing, so infinitesimally small, I'll destroy a city. No one would have believed that because that's scale change. So we're now used to scale change. We're used to this kind of spooky world where, you know, there's incredible energy locked up in an atom. So I suppose my mind speculates that that's a bit like Jesus, like it's the atomic bomb to end all atomic bombs, except it's a glory bomb. You know, this tiny little atom, everything done there, and it will be released. Not yet. We are yet to participate in it. We have what the Bible calls the taste of it. It is true. We don't yet fully participate in it. So with that kind of bigger view, beginning in creation, going to the idea of the destiny of rule, that destiny being recovered in resurrection, with a hope of an extension of a refurbished, resurrected heaven and earth, with that world view, you can see I now have a reason to enter politics, solve problems, because I think I'm building for eternity. You know, so on my dark days when I think no one's listening to me and I'm feeling sorry for myself and it's all not coming to what I want, I think, well, no, it's going to go through. And I'm just now realising what Paul said in Corinthians when he says that, you know, whatever we build on the foundation we've got, some will carry through and some won't. Do you know that one in Corinthians? Some will be burnt up like wood, hay and stubble, and some will go through like gold. So, you know, the best of what I do will go through and the bad days will get burnt up. Just we want to have a lot of good days. But and God's not interested in scope. He doesn't care whether you're the prime minister or just, you know, a carer of one person. The scale doesn't interest God in terms of what he's looking for. He's just looking for his glory to be expressed in local situations. But they will endure. So the imagination of Christians has got terribly diverted by heaven, terribly diverted by heaven. You know, I like discussions like, do you reckon the Ninth Symphony will get through? You know, I think it probably will. And you start to really, I mean, I was having this conversation with your dad, you know, and we really need to start thinking about this because it just changes everything. You start to get goosebumps thinking, wow, this is sort of, it's already begun. The New Jerusalem Act 2 has already begun, you know, and so what will continue and how will it go through? Then of course, what happens is we view what we're doing now as incredibly important, you know, because it's not a throwaway item. So for the Papuans, when they heard this message, they said, well, I say business is, you know, it's not a throwaway item. I can bring the glory of God to running a shop or, you know, building an airstrip or whatever, because it's actually part of this work. So there you go. That's the opening stanza in the three modules. And next time we'll look at the patriarchs and how that turned into the notion of blessing, which is really interesting, how rule became blessing. So one thing to say, just which I should say in closing, if you want to pursue the kind of broad backbone of these ideas, finally someone's written a readable good book on it. It's Tom Wright, and he's packaged lots of this up. I'm a bit more extreme than Tom is in some ways because he's a churchman and academic after all, but he's way, way better than I am in putting the story together. And the book's Surprised by Hope, which if any of these ideas are new to you, or even if they're not, that's just a heck of a read. So I think what we'll do now is just, I know I said we'd have some discussion, but I think it's, if anyone's got any questions, by all means.